En primer lloc, agrair la presència de la conferenciant en aquesta jornada, així com l'esforç personal que li ha comportat estar aquí amb tots nosaltres. Estem molt contents i contentes de comptar amb la doctora Han Tonensen, ja que, com veuran seguidament, el seu currículum professional i formatiu acredita amb escreix la seva rellevància en l'àmbit de la promoció de la salut i les institucions sanitàries, especialment dels hospitals. La doctora Han Tonensen és doctora en Ciències Mèdiques, directora del Centre Col·laborador de l'Organització Mundial de la Salut, la promoció de la salut basada en l'evidència, en hospitals i serveis sanitaris des del 2004 i és directora de recerca de l'Hospital de Vipersberg de Copenhagen. Des del 1999 i fins al 2005 va ser directora de la Unitat Clínica de Promoció de la Salut d'aquest hospital i des del 2005 és responsable de la Secretaria Internacional de la Xarxa d'Hospitals Promotors de la Salut promoguda per l'OMS i de la que formen part 700 centres i institucions. És una persona, doncs, que amb la seva trajectòria professional equilibra perfectament la docència, la recerca i la pràctica clínica. Així, per fer una petita ressenya del seu currículum, pel que fa a la seva formació acadèmica, ressaltar que l'any 2003 es va doctorar a la mateixa Universitat de Copenhagen, defensant la tesi l'abús de l'alcohol i la morbiditat postoperatòria. I l'any 2009 va tenir l'acreditació de professorat clínic de la Universitat de Lund. Pel que fa a la seva trajectòria de recerca, comentar que ha liderat nombrosos projectes internacionals de recerca multicèntrica i la seva producció científica del darrer 5 anys sobrepassa el centenar de publicacions. Tanmateix, la seva trajectòria docent passa, entre altres, per compartir, i especialment focalitzat en la formació de doctorat, estades amb la Universitat de Lund, de Bergen, de Copenhagen i altres universitats arreu del món. També ha liderat nombroses edicions a les escoles d'estiu de promoció de la salut, dels hospitals i de serveis de salut, patrocinats també per l'Organització Mundial de la Salut. Bé, no vull allargar més del necessari amb aquesta presentació, només amb aquesta he pretès doncs, esbossar el perfil del conferenciant a través d'aquesta breu ressenya curricular i dir que realment és un verdader plaer per nosaltres descomptar doncs, amb la presència de la doctora Tonensen aquí entre nosaltres, que tot seguit desenvoluparà la seva ponència titulada Promoció de la salut en l'àmbit clínic. Anne, thank you for being here with us and welcome to Girona.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all the nice words. Dear HPH members, dear colleagues, dear friends, I'm very sorry that I do not speak Spanish or Catalonia, but I have heard that there's a translation. Does it work? Okay. Can I have the first slide? It's really great to be here today. Yesterday I came from Stockholm, which is a part of Scandinavia, and there was snow, -3 degrees Celsius. So to be here is like a summertime. So it's really great. So sorry for this very long introduction. Health promotion in hospitals and health services is very, very important. I think we can all agree that it would be much better if we had health promotion in the families, in the primary care, at the working places, the schools, the universities, everywhere outside the hospitals. And in the ideal world, this will happen. However, today we have patients knocking at the hospital door with very unhealthy lifestyle. And therefore, we need to make health promotion, we need to do health promotion activities inside the hospitals and health services, at least for the next 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years, I don't know when, but at least for a period. I'm going to present a little about our collaborating center in Copenhagen. What are we doing? What are we working with? I also give you a very short update on the on the HPH network development. Then I will talk very much about our WHO HPA tools, how they can support the implementation of health promotion in hospitals and health services. And then in the end, I will introduce very shortly our new official scientific journal for health promotion in hospitals and health services. This is our collaborating center, WHO collaborating center in Copenhagen. We refer directly to the World Health Organization and also to the management in our hospital. So our WHO collaborating center is placed inside a hospital. We work with research, education, of course the HPH network, and also clinical effect databases. All collaborating centers of WHO have terms of references. It is something you have promised to do. And our terms of references are to implement WHO principles for health promotion. I mean, we are not talking about Denmark or Scandinavia, we are talking about the whole world. So it's a huge work we have on our shoulders. We have also promised to support countries to use the health promotion strategies and standards to create further evidence. It means that we should still continue our research in this field. We have promised to support countries in teach and train the staff in evidence-based health promotion, and also to support countries in implementing the best evidence-based health promotion into the clinical daily life. Evidence-based health promotion is so important. When I entered the network of health promoting hospitals 10 years ago, there was a lot of ideology. And ideology is okay, but it was very much about, I feel this treatment is better than the other treatment, or I think that if we do this, it must be better than doing that. And if we want to implement health promotion in an evidence-based world, and hospitals are evidence-based, at least to some degree, then we need to put health promotion on the evidence-based platform. And already in 2000, the general director of WHO, Gro Harlem Brundtland, said that health promotion should be based on evidence rather than ideology. And when we're talking about evidence, I'm not only talking about the knowledge, the existing research that gives us the best knowledge. I'm also adding staff expertise, and that is why some of you are here today, that is to learn more, to become better, to be able to implement health promotion for the benefit of the patient, but also the staff and also the community. So staff expertise is very, very important. The most important part is probably the patient preferences. It is so important to get the patient on board, to have them to ask for health promotion. I'm not the only one to say this. You can see that it was said already, published in 2000 by the father, if you can say it, Professor Sackett, the father of the evidence-based medicine. We can act, we can integrate health promotion in all patients' pathway, all the clinical pathways can have integrated health promotion. Even surgery. I have some examples on how to add health promotion into the surgical pathway. And that is, of course, because I'm a surgeon. 10 years ago, we published the very first study in the world on intervention, preoperative alcohol intervention for patients undergoing resection operations on their colon and rectum. And we could show that this is the complication rate up here in percentages. And you can see that about 75 to 76% of the patients had a complication. If we, in a randomized controlled trial, added intervention before surgery, 4 weeks of alcohol stop before surgery can halve the complication rate after surgery. A very small change in lifestyle, 4 weeks, can increase the outcome so much. It's really amazing. It's like seeing the penicillin introduced to the operation theater. Another important study, also the first in the world, concerning smoking intervention in relation to surgery, was published in Lancet 2002. And this concerns patients undergoing hip and knee operations, hip and knee replacement therapy. And you can see that half of the smokers have a complication after this kind of a surgery. And if we add also in a proper randomized controlled trial design, if we add an intervention, a preoperative smoking cessation program, we can reduce the complication rate to less than 20%. When you look upon this complications rate, many surgeons will say, oh, I don't have all this kind of complications. I only have 2% of my patients have complications. Well, that might be the truth if you put out some tunnel vision, so you only look into the operation area. But if you include all kinds of complications, if you include pneumonia and other kind of infections, then you will end up at this high number of complications. It means that alcohol patients undergoing surgery, smokers undergoing surgery, are high risk patients. The association between smoking and increased complications after surgery, the association that smokers have double as many complications as non-smokers, that association was published in the end of 1940. We have had that knowledge for more than 50 years. More than 400 papers have been published about this association. I can understand that we need to publish 20 or 30, 50 papers showing, wow, smokers have more complications after surgery. But 400 papers before the very first study of intervention arrived. That is crazy. Think about how many extra complications we have added to our patients. We knew the complications would come, and we have done nothing. Today, this was the first study. Today, 12 studies have been published, all showing that if you have a very intensive program before surgery, you can reduce the complication. If you only have a minor program, like this finger, you know that, stop smoking, it doesn't work. Does not change smoking, it does not change the surgical complications. But if you have this gold standard program before surgery, you can reduce your complication rate extremely. And if you now think that with alcohol and smoking, that is enough, please look at the next study. This concerns physical exercise before major spine surgery. This is not just some small spine surgery. This is really this is major spine surgery where you stabilize the spine with some pins. And you can see here that if you have an intensive intervention program 8 weeks prior to surgery, you can reduce the stay in hospital with 1/3. It means that you can operate the patient on Monday and they can leave the hospital on Thursday. That is really, and that includes also rehabilitation program after surgery. That is really, really fantastic. So we need health promotion everywhere, not only in the primary care, but also in the hospitals, not only for smokers with lung disease or cardiac insufficiency, but also even for surgical patients, for mental ill patients, for parents of children, hospitalized children. Smoking is so dangerous in relation to surgery that children of smoking parents have increased complications after surgery. What are you doing for your surgical patients in Girona? In the future, you will do a lot. I know that. This is just to show you that the only two programs that worked that can reduce the complication rate, this is the percentages here of complications. This was the study you saw before, and this is a newer study from Sweden. And I have happened to be the supervisor of all these intervention studies. And you can see here that only if you have an intensive program to stop smoking before surgery, you can have an effect. If you just have a short program, brief advice, folders, or just 1 hour giving good advices or motivational interviewing technique, then there's absolutely no influence on the complication rate. This is not statistically significant different. This is statistically significant different. Oh yeah, this is really interesting. We have looked here upon the persons from the Lancet study, 2002. We have looked upon the smokers. We have looked upon those who reduced smoking to less than half. It means that if you have smoked 80 cigarettes per day, then you should reduce to less than 40. If you have smoked 10 cigarettes, you should reduce to less than 5. And this is the persons who had stopped smoking completely. And you can see if you look at all the complications, there's no statistical difference between the smokers and those reducing. The whole difference is kept in the group who stopped completely smoking. If you only look at the infections, then this is not a failure. I've not missed anything here. There was absolutely no infections in the group that stopped completely smoking this 6 to 8 weeks before surgery. So we can really change the life for our surgical patients here. The reason that this intervention works is that we can have a patient to stop smoking. This is the quit rate of smokers, and you can see that in the intervention group, the quit rate was very, very high compared to the no intervention group. And this is also the case for the Swedish study, the similar Swedish study. But it seems that surgery, not only surgery, but also every contact, a medical doctor, a nurse, and everybody working in the health service, every contact is a teachable moment for the patient to change the lifestyle. But you need to offer proper programs, intensive programs, not only this finger. It doesn't work. Not at home, not in hospitals. What we also do in our collaborating center is teaching and training. That is also why I'm here today. We have the international HPH, WHO schools every year. In October, we had one in South Korea. So we have every 3 or 4 months, we have a WHO school somewhere in the world. I'm looking forward, maybe you will have one in the previous time. We'll be happy to support you. We also have PhD courses in this field. We teach and train physicians, diploma nurses, of course also students. And from 2012, we are opening an international master in clinical health promotion. Because it is so important that you know how to handle these problems. And then of course, since we're evidence-based, we also make research scientific projects on our teaching and training. Well, back to the HPH. You know that the International Network of Health Promoting Hospitals is a network of networks. The International Network is like an umbrella network, and it includes all the national regional networks in the world. And what we are doing and what you are doing in your network is to work toward to reorient hospitals and health services towards a better health gain. I'm not saying that treatment does not give a better health gain. Of course it does. If you have a broken hip and you go to the hospital, your health will be better after surgery than it was before. No doubt about that. But by adding health promotion, we can get an even better health gain. That is the overall goal of the international and the national regional networks. The international network was initiated by WHO in 1995, and it is aimed at patients. That's why we are here, it's because of the patients, but also the staff and of course the community. This is the map, the world map of HPH. Today we have 802 member hospitals and health services from all over the world. We have 38 national regional networks, and we have members from in total 40 countries. You can see here the green dots represents the networks, and of course there are many networks in Europe because the international network was established in Europe, but you can also see that it spreads out now. We have two networks in Canada and two in United States. We have one in Australia. We have one in Asia. There will be two more in Asia, one in Singapore, one in South Korea. We have one. You know that we say Spain because it is so important to have this collaboration. Previously, you could have a regional network if you want to have that, but today we want to work towards national networks. It's important that you are able, not you, but everybody is able to collaborate with your neighbors, not only being able to collaborate internationally. So for instance, Germany, one of the biggest countries in Europe, they have 80 million citizens. They have one network, even though they have seven states in Germany. And that is the future, that is to work together. The development of the network, I know you are already aware of that. I'll do it very short. This was the period until 97, where it changed from a project to a European network. And in 2004, it became internationally. We decided that why only stay in Europe? We had so many persons interested in the network from all over the world. So why not integrate it all and make an international network? We did that. We also decided to have an international secretariat that was established in our WHO collaborating center in Copenhagen. The year after, we established a General Assembly and a Governance Board. 2008, the HPH Constitution came into reality. 2009, we had the first common international strategy. Here in 2010, we represent 800 members. We had a new website. Please go and visit it. And in 2011, we will have the scientific journal of clinical health promotion aimed at patient, staff, and community. The Constitution focus on the purpose and objectives and the rules for decisions and relationships for members and partners. And you can see here, our daily work, our mission is to work towards incorporating the WHO concepts, values, strategies, standards, or indicators into the organizational structures of the hospitals and health services. And the vision, the reason for doing all this, is not just to meet and have some coffee and talk and all this kind of things. The vision is that the patient will have a better health care. That is the most important part. To be able to give our patient a better health gain, we also need to give the staff a better health. And we also need to work to across the borders between the sectors, not only primary, secondary health sectors, but also social and health sectors, the social sector and the healthcare sector. This is the structure. And please be aware, this is not a company. This is a network where people spend their spare time, very often without having any extra salary. A network is organized different from a company. In a company, you have a director in the top, or at university, you have a director in the top and a governance board. Here we have the General Assembly in the top. The General Assembly consists of the national regional networks. National regional networks are our core members. The network, regional network in Catalonia are one of the core members in this network, in the international network. And they decide what to do. The governance board are the executors. They have to make sure that what was decided here is also put into reality. But the directors, if you can say that, those, the decision makers are sitting here. Then we have two secretariats, one for the general secretariat in our collaborating center and a conference secretariat. This is the governance bodies, if you can say that. Then we have the operational level. And here's the national regional networks. We also have several individual hospitals and health services as members in areas where they do not exist a network yet. We work through task forces, and task forces can only be decided by the General Assembly. The General Assembly has to say, we want a task force in this area. It could be for children, it could be for mental ill patients, it could be for smoke-free hospitals or something like that. But only the General Assembly can make this kind of decisions. Then we also have some working groups. In the General Assembly, as I said, the national regional coordinators, that also mean Dolores from Catalonia, is the core members. We also have the representatives from the two formal collaborating centers. There are much more collaborating centers working together with the network, but there are only two formal collaborating centers in the Constitution. Then we have a WHO representative, we have the task force leaders invited, and we have observers from upcoming networks. It means that the network from upcoming network, for instance, from South Korea, they are invited to participate in the next General Assembly. Then we have the governance board that consists of 7 elected members. They are the only members with voting rights. Also here, the only members with voting rights are the national regional coordinators. So you can see it's really another organization compared to a company. I think I've said that already. What we do in the International Secretariat is to support, give technical support, to follow up, also to make sure that you can exchange knowledge and experience at the international level. We take care of new memberships. We also take care of budget and balances and a lot more. We follow up on the communication. We try to facilitate. We try to empower the network, like you try to empower your patients. So we have a lot of work to do in the international network. Individual members in the network can be members by signing a letter of intent within a national regional network like you have in Catalonia, but it could also be in cases where you have no national regional network, then you sign up with the secretariat, international secretariat. If you have only three hospitals and health services, you can establish a network. But it has to be an open network. This is not a problem in your part of the world. But in other parts of the world, it may be a problem that you have to invite the neighbors, maybe some with another religion or some with another opinion. And that is really some hard work we are doing in the secretariat and in the international network, is to make people work together in the neighborhood. You also have to establish a national regional coordinator like Dolores, and then you need to have a coordinating institution to support. Maybe you already know the international task forces. Otherwise, they are mentioned here and they are open. If you want to join them, if you want, for instance, to work with alcohol intervention in hospitals and health services, you can go to our website and find the address of Sverre Nesvåg from Norway and take contact to him, and then you can join the international task force. We have the very new task force on HPH and the environment that is leaded by the regional coordinator, Professor Shuti Cho from Taiwan. And that is also open for collaboration. The working groups we have in the international network is a working group for health, on health promotion for staff and healthy workplaces. We have one on patient safety. We have the Clinical Scientific Journal, as you can see here. And then we have some pre-working groups, upcoming working groups. They want to focus on physical activity and also on health promotion in non-hospitals organizations. This is our new scientific journal. We're so proud of it. It has taken 5 years to make the decision. It's not easy to make decisions internationally. 5 years. And the first issue will be on the street in June 2011, and it will be free of charge. You can see that we already have an editor, Oliver Grøne, from Spain. But we also have some other editors. We have Jürgen Pelikan from Austria. We have David O. Warner, from a professor at the Mayo Clinic in the United States. We have Professor Henrik Møller from the King's College University in United Kingdom, and a lot of other important persons. We have one place, one seat open. That is for a professor in Africa, South America, or Australia. We want to have this global approach in our scientific journal. We are looking for professors for our professor panel of peer reviewers, and we have already asked Dolores to find somebody from Catalonia to join this peer reviewer panel. You will have no salary, only work and honor. This is how we exchange knowledge and experience in the network. We have, of course, our international HPH conferences, and it's so important that you come to those conferences. It's really some special conferences, not the traditional scientific conference where everything is a fight, where you need to cut the head of your colleagues or something like that. It's really a friendly atmosphere where we exchange knowledge and experience. Then there's the national regional conferences, workshops and meetings. We have the General Assembly meeting where we always include some workshops where the national regional coordinators can exchange their knowledge and experience. For instance, what are you doing here in this country and what are they doing in Taiwan and how does it work and things like that. So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's so important that we use what is already established from other areas. And believe me, we are so similar. There are much more similarities than differences. Very often when you come into a group, for instance, when you meet people in France, you will say, oh, they're so different. We have so many differences. It's very traditional to focus on all the differences before you focus on the similarities. But I mean, we struggle with the same problems. And if they have a solution in South Africa, why not use that? Why try to find something else by yourself? Spend your energy and power for development and for better health gain for your patient. I think I've been talking about everything else here. We also have a newsletter. We have some tools, HPH external communication plan. We have a toolbox on the website. We have a staff exchange program. It means that if you want to learn more about health promotion at another hospital or health service, for instance, Finland, you can go there, exchange for a week or a month, whatever fits, and then you will have a Finnish person to visit your country. And then, of course, we have all the schools. Implementing health promotion is like building pyramids. We know what to do, but it's not easy to do it. It's like hearing an opera. You know the sound of the music, you know how it should sound, but you're not able always to sing it yourself. Some of you may be, but not all of us. And this is the same thing here, implementing health promotion. We have all the basic part. We have the visions and values. We have the HPH strategies, we have the standards and indicators, and I know that it has been translated into Spain. And this is really, really good that you have something you can read in a language close to the Catalonia language. We are able to monitor the effect of what we are doing. We have clinical guidelines, we have educations, and please use what is already established. Then adapt it to your own, to your local condition, but it's so easy just to take what exists. The tools are important, the standards, the HPH data model for identification, and the documentation model for activities are so useful to make health promotion visible. I'm sure you do a lot of activities in your hospitals and health services that are completely invisible. In Denmark, we made a research study. We asked all the hospital departments what they were doing of health promotion activities. And then we looked at we have a national register of activities. And then we looked at that register, could see that only 10% of the activities really given to the patient. Only 10% were registered in the national registry, at the national registry. It means that 90% was invisible. It means it's like the top of an iceberg. So it's so important to document in a simple way what you're doing. How can we ask for money to this important field if we cannot show what we are doing? Who would offer money to somebody asking, saying, I need some money for this, and then those who have the money will say, could you send me some description of what you're doing and what the effect you expect to get, etc., etc., and you would say, no. How would you ever be able to get money to attract money and power resources to this field? We have to do the registration, but it has to be simple, because those who are doing it, the medical doctors, the nurses, the physiotherapists, the occupational therapists, the midwives, the nursing assistants, everybody, general practitioners, they should have most time together with the patients. If we ask them to spend more time on registration, we take the time away from it for the patients. So we have developed some very, very simple models, and it has to be simple because I'm just a simple surgeon. I cannot understand this multi many pages reports and forms. I'm a little afraid because the interpreter is looking. Oh, it's okay. Sorry. So we have developed these models, and they are not developed at a desk. They have also been tested in the clinical setting. And we have to respect the clinical persons because they are the person to do this kind of stuff. We can sit outside at a university and say it would be beautiful to do this and that. But the clinicians are the persons who have to do it in real life. So in respect of them, we need to make something that is useful. Okay. This is the three models. You already know the standards that has been translated. This huge area is described by five standards. Only five standards. One on policy, one on patient assessment, one on patient intervention and information, one of the healthy workplaces, and one of the continuity and collaboration, cooperation across the sectors. Five standards. Do you know how many standards and indicators they have in the Joint Commission Accreditation Organization? 800. This is really, really simple. And the standards are based on evidence. They are developed, they are described, they are tested, adjusted, and retested. So they really fulfill all the ISCVA criteria for standards. We also have the model related to standard number two, the data model, we call it, HPH data model. That is a very simple model for documentation of the health determinants of the patients. It has to be simple. It should only support the medical doctor, the decision maker, or the nurse, the person to decide what shall we do with this patient. I'll come back to that in a moment. And then, of course, we also have to document the activities. What are we doing with these patients? Are we only identifying smokers? Or are we giving them a smoking cessation course program? This is the standards as you know them. This book was published in 2006, and before that there was a draft book published in 2003 or 2004. But the scientific paper was published this year. And in the network, national, regional, international network, we really have to be keen about these publications. The scientific publications are so important. These are fingerprints staying forever in the Medline register, the PubMed, so everybody can find it afterwards. A book, you can put it somewhere and then everybody will forget about it. But if it is published as a scientific paper, everybody can find it for the next 50 years. If you look upon the clinical pathway, then the first step is the identification. This is similar to diagnosing a disease. Here we identify the need for health promotion among the patients. It is easily connected to the international classification of diseases from WHO, and you also have money related to that, diagnosed related groups. Nearly all all countries in Europe and most of the whole world use this DRG system for reimbursement. It's really important that we get some money for doing this kind of work. The next step is the intervention, the treatment, where we need to diagnose, to register what we are doing in the same way as we register surgery operations. And we can add money to that as well. And then, of course, we have to follow up. What is the result of what we are doing? And that could be followed up in so-called quality databases or clinical databases. And they are also related to the ICD-10 or 11 diagnose disease system. In the United States, in Canada, somewhere in Asia, they now use the SNOMED. That is a more comprehensive description of diagnosis, where the ICD 10 or 11 only includes 45,000 different codes, then the SNOMED can include more than 100,000 different codes. Isn't that amazing? We came up with 5 codes here. We came up with 17 codes here. So, I mean, we really try to keep it simple compared to the complicated world in the hospital registration systems. Standard number 2, you know that already. The organization ensures that health professionals in partnership with the patient systematically assess needs for health promotion activities. Means that you have to diagnose the needs of the patient. Easy. Or is it? The substandards here say that there should be guidelines on identification of risk factors. It means that in all departments, in the hospitals, health services, there should be some guidelines saying how do we identify these risk factors. The guidelines should be revised annually, checked, and there should also be guidelines for groups of patients. It means that it could be patients with chronic diseases, surgical patients, mental ill patients, etc. Here comes a very, very important substandard. That is that you should be able to document it in the medical record. How do you do that? I mean, we don't care how you diagnose it, how you identify it. You can ask the patient, or you can make some measurement, or you can ask the patient's wife, or whatever. You can use complicated score systems if you want. But the documentation has to be simple. And therefore, we developed this HPH data model. In order to do that, we made it as a research study. We included several countries. You can see that you may feel like Catalonia, but I'm sorry to say, but I have to say Spain. I know that Catalonia is a region in Spain, but in United Nations, you do not have a seat for yourself. You have a common seat together with Spain, so that is why I have to say that. It's not a problem for you, I know that, but when it comes to, for instance, Taiwan, they are also a region in China, and I mean, I have to speak this kind of language, so please forgive me. I have my own opinion, and then I have the official language. But you can see that Spain is included here, and we have a lot of other countries as well. What we did in this data model was that we focused on only 5 risk factors. There are, of course, much more risk factors, but we began with the 5 most important risk factors for the patient outcome. And that is risk of malnutrition, that is physical inactivity, that is overweight, that is daily smoking, any amount of daily smoking, and that is harmful drinking. And this is for patients. Please be aware that if you have a body mass index below 20.5, this is important for patients. If it comes to the community, for healthy people, the limit is, as you may know, 18 or 18.5. But when it comes to patients, it's very important to be focused on the risk of malnutrition because that kills our patient. They only get complications by smoking, drinking, being obese, but when they're malnourished, they die. What we did was that we need to support the clinical decision process. It means that we should be able to document if our patients needed or did not need this kind of smoking intervention, alcohol intervention, physical activity training program, overweight intervention, malnutrition intervention. We need to put the patient into two groups, those in need and those without need. Is it too simple? It's very simple, at least. So we developed this 9 questions HPH model. Maybe I should say also that this is based upon the international guidelines of risk of malnutrition accepted by the international scientific societies of Europe, America, and Asia. This is the general recommendations also internationally. This is the overweight. Please be aware that we say 25, not 30. You know, in the United States, so many people are so big that they have changed the normal body mass index to say 30 because they think it's not possible to get people under the real limit that is 25. And I mean, we cannot have that. We are here to not only to treat, but also to prevent people to becoming too big, too fat. So we need to stay on the evidence, and that is 25. So we ended up with this 9 questions. 4 questions for risk of malnutrition, 2 questions on overweight. 1 question, is the patient physically active less than half an hour per day? Does the patient smoke daily? Does the patient drink this hazardous amount of alcohol intake? This is so simple. In many medical records, we have a long history of the smoking habits of the patient, saying the patient began smoking when he was 15. He began with 5 cigarettes per day, and then he increased until he was 18. He increased his smoking up to 20 cigarettes per day. Then he had a short break, and then he relapsed to smoking, etc., etc., and you count and you do all this kind of stuff. But what is the only information we need to decide if this patient should have a smoking cessation program? The only thing we need is to know if the patient is a smoker or a non-smoker. If the patient has been a smoker previously, we cannot offer that patient a program. I mean, if you do not smoke, if you smoke when you were young and do not smoke today, it would make no sense to say, oh, look here, we have a stop smoking program for you. It's completely ridiculous. So why put all this information in the medical record? Of course you can do it. It's voluntarily. You can do whatever you'd like to do. But please focus on the key question here. Is the patient a smoker? Yes. Then the patient should have a smoking cessation program. No. You can say, oh, wow, that's really good. Please continue being a non-smoker. Does it make sense? Great. You don't need to go to a WHO school. You know everything. So So what we did was that we asked the pilots that the pilot centers that volunteered to the I know it's close to coffee time, but I'm sure I can take 5 minutes more. That's great. Thank you. Somebody took my time. We asked the pilot centers to implement the HPH model. When you develop this kind of models, you can go to a hospital or health service and ask them, what do you think about the model? Then you will get their immediate attitude, their approach, their meaning. But it's much better to ask them to use the model for a period and then ask about, what do you think about it? Then you will get a qualified meaning, attitude, response. So that was what we did. All those persons from all the centers, they evaluated this model in a set of international standardized medical records. They were translated into English. So all the centers evaluated the same records. We want to know if you did the same in Spain, if you came out with the same result in Italy, etc. And then, of course, we also need to know, would they work at local level? So they also look at their local medical records to evaluate if it works. Means actually that we have been asking our clinical, specialist, medical doctors, we asked them to do 6,319 evaluations in the standards plus the 10,620 evaluation. That is a lot of considerations you have. You really need to spend some time doing this job. And they all did it. It was so amazing. And after this, then we asked them, do you find the questionnaire for documentation useful, applicable, and sufficient? And it was easy to define this word. It just says that usefulness means that it is intuitive, useful for the clinical specialists. It is applicable for your group of patients. And the sufficiency means that does it cover the whole group of your patient, or are we missing something here? I mean, if you measure the body mass index on patient with amputated legs, you will get a very, very high body mass index, but that is false. If you have a pregnant woman, then the body mass index will also be very high if you just measure it like that, but that is, of course, also false. After 9 months, it will be significantly reduced. So we want to know, was it covered? Was the group of patients covered by this? Here you can see the countries, the regions, nation participating, and you can see that we asked 78 different hospitals and health services from all over the world. 79 of course, 71 responded, and 8 returned the forms without information. And if it comes to the other part with the local conditions, 59 responded with information, 6 returned the papers without information. And this is the agreement. And it may be sufficient. This is the percentages of agreement. This is when the agreement requires a majority, meaning that more than half of the clinical specialists agreed with each other about this. And qualified majority means that more than 2/3 of them should agree before we said that they agreed. And have a look here. You can really see that this is amazing high values. Very often when you put, for instance, 10 clinical specialists into one room, they will come out with 11 different meanings. So this is really fantastic to get this kind of agreement. When we do the statistical analysis using the CAPA statistics, it says that 0.85 in average, and that is near to perfect agreement. You cannot ask for more. So it really seems that we have been able to develop a very simple model that is useful, understandable, and applicable in real day life. We looked at the different questions. For instance, there were 4 questions on malnutrition, and when it comes to the body mass index, nearly everybody found it understandable, applicable, and sufficient. Weight loss was also very okay. Reduced intake of food, and also if you were severely ill, having higher requirements for food during your stay in hospital. But what was surprising was the overweight body mass index was easy to use. When it comes to the measurement of waist, it was really surprising. It was easy to understand that you should measure the waist, but the clinicians didn't like it. They don't find it applicable, and they don't find it sufficient. And that is really something we need to listen to. Why is it that way? And it's probably a question of traditions. I mean, I've been working with body mass index for so many years. I can actually look at a person and see if this person is in the risk of malnutrition or overweight. Just by looking at the patient I have with my clinical view, I can see this is a patient in risk of this and that. Not always, because of course I have to measure the weight and the height, but I have a view on that. But I have no view on waist measurement. I cannot look at a patient this patient have a bigger waist. And then there's another problem with waist measurement. It's easy to measure the waist for women. But if you have a man with a form of an egg, where is the waist? And that is really something we have to learn. There's clear definitions on how to do it, find the hip and the rib, and then between, and et cetera, et cetera. But we have to train this. So I think that is the reason that the clinicians don't like it. Physical activity was very okay. Smoking, I mean, this is like a dream scenario, and harmful drinking as well. So we also asked for comments, and they said that the details in the HPH data model, that they wanted more information in general. It means that some of the clinicians said, oh, we would like to have more information. We cannot just use this simple 9 questions. However, if you want more information, you can always add it. The model is so simple, it can be, you can put whatever you'd like on the top of it, as long as this is just the minimum. It only includes the basic information. Then there were some comments about usefulness, and that was mainly about the waist measurements. It will really require a strong support to implement that all medical doctors, all nurses can have this measurement band tape, that you are able to measure, that you have something extra in your pocket to measure the waist of the patients. And then again, the evidence for the patients were questioned because waist measurements and overweight is based upon population studies, not on patient studies. So we really have to be careful when we want to implement this kind of waist measurement. And then they said that concerning non-understandable areas was the question about severe illness. They want some more explanations. What was meant by stress metabolic third degree? If you are stress metabolic third degree, it means that you use so much energy to stay alive that you need to have some extra food, some extra nutrition. And if you work in areas, in for instance, surgery, anesthesia, other kind of areas, intensive care units, departments where you use this term, then it is easy to understand. But I mean, this should be applicable for all hospital departments. So we need to add that this means that you have a more than 50% burned skin, third degree, major trauma, AME, fulminate, sepsis, etc., etc. So it's really, really ill patients. It's not just that you feel a little stressed, something like that. But we added that, today, this data model is under consideration for publication in British Medical Journal. And we hope, of course, it will be published very soon. And those of you, because I'm sure that some of your hospitals, I know that some of your hospitals have participated, I'd like to say thank you very much for the participation in this project. I hope you will implement it. It has already been implemented in Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Canada, and some areas in Germany. And in Taiwan, they use it, and they have this internet technique. So they have a pop-up. They have electronic medical records with a pop-up saying, is this patient a smoker? Have you remembered to offer a smoking cessation program, et cetera, et cetera. So they have this IT, this is an IT wonderland. So they can do all this kind of stuff also. But if you want to know more about these models, then I think you should take contact to your colleagues in the HPH network or go to the homepage and look at some persons there you can collaborate with and exchange knowledge and experience. I'll stop here. I know you know the next part because that was published several years ago. And then I'll say thank you very much for the invitation. All my slides will be published in a PDF file at your website. I've promised that. And I'm looking so much forward to our future collaboration in the international network. And good luck with all your work in Catalonia.
Thank you very much for your splendid conference. And then we are open a round on questions. Alguna pregunta, algun comentari?
Good morning. Thank you for this great conference. Només una pregunta. Quan parlen de el parar l'hàbit tabàquic, quant temps consideren que passa perquè una persona pugui recaure en aquest apartat? O sigui, quant temps, un mes, un any, perquè pugui ser valorable l'eficàcia d'aquesta actuació per la prevenció de les complicacions postoperatòries o d'altres malalties. És senzillament això només.
Now, Sorry, I don't speak your language. Sorry, I didn't understand it. But as I have understood, the beautiful translation is that you ask if a person stops smoking, for how long time should the person stop smoking before it is permanent? Is that correct? It's really different from one person to another. But if you have stopped smoking for half a year, then your relapse rate is very, very small. But it also it is related to which kind of support you get when you stop smoking. If you just get this lifted finger, or short advice, short recommendation, stop smoking, then only a few percentages will be non-smokers after half a year. But if you have this the gold standard programs that takes 6 weeks with a manual-based patient education and nicotine replacement therapy for support, then you can end up with 25 to 50% that are still non-smokers after half a year. And if you look at our surgical patients, they are so brilliant. They are a higher degree of them are non-smokers after 1 year, and they have not been smoking from the time of the operation and when we evaluate them after 1 year. So it's really a teachable moment, if you can say that, but it mostly related to the support you get, and the patients are so happy for support.
Hola. Sí? Que ha parlat de les 9 preguntes que es fan per avaluar la salut del pacient, però els estàndards també tenen a veure amb els professionals i voldria saber com s'estudia l'estat de salut dels professionals. Gràcies. Little.
It's really, really important to support the staff in their in getting a better health, because they are the ambassadors. They are the persons who should support the patients. And I'm very happy for this question, because it seems that if you are a smoker yourself, you cannot support patients in stop smoking. If you are too big, if you are too fat, you cannot support your patients in losing weight. I'm so sorry, and it sounds very unprofessional, but that is the case. I'm very happy that I'm a surgeon, because in my area, we don't need to undergo surgery ourselves to be able to support our surgical patients. But it has been shown in several studies that smoking nurses have no success in getting their patients to stop smoking. So that is one reason that it is so important to support the health of the staff. That is because they support their patients. The other reason is that staff in hospitals and health services is a huge group in the country or the region. And supporting their health also means that they can can influence their families and their friends, so they're not the only one to benefit from it. What we have done in many years in our hospital is to evaluate every third year, we evaluate the health of the staff. We do it in self-reporting. It is completely anonymous. Previously we used hard copies. They filled in and delivered in a mailbox. Today we do it online at the hospital, but we don't do it ourselves. We have the university to do it in order to keep this anonymous to keep the staff completely anonymous. And what we ask for is exactly the same five risk factors, but we also add the stress level, burnout scales, and we also ask for their chronic diseases, if they take any medication. And further to that, we have added a part of how do you feel being a staff in our hospital? Do you get the support from the colleagues that you want? Do you get the support from your closest leader? Does the hospital management support you? What would you ask for if you could wish, etc., etc.? So we put the threats, how the staff grow, if you can say that, together with their health. And that is so important to add those two things together, because it's one staff can have several, I mean, it's the same person like it is for patients. The staff is, some of them have a very healthy lifestyle, but they have a very unhealthy life due to burnout, problems, etc. And followed by that, we have in our hospitals and many other hospitals, we have some advisement. We have a smoking cessation program for staff. They can use it during working hour. It's free. They have the nicotine replacement free. They can repeat the course if they want. We have a similar intervention for alcohol and drug abuse, because we don't want to kick our staff out of the door. We want to keep them, to take care of them, because they are so competent. So that is really important. We have dietitians giving intervention. We have physiotherapists to support those with low back pain. That is a very common problem for nurses. We have a lot of other, if you have problems in your department, we have an acute service you can call. If you have a collaboration problem in your department, you can call an acute service. We have ergonomic support, so you will have the best way of sitting. And it sounds like it's very expensive, but it's not. It's much more expensive to have high sick leave than to have to pay for a healthy staff. So we repeat this surveys for the staff every third year, and we can see that in the middle of 1996, I think it was, we made a profile of the staff, of the patient, and of the community. And get what? We all look like each other. The staff was exactly as unhealthy as the patient. And wonder why? I mean, we recruit the staff from the community and the patient from the community, so of course we were similar. Since then, we add all these services for the staff, and today, less than 8% of the medical doctors are smokers. More than 70 to 80% of the staff are physically active every day, half an hour. Alcohol intake is very low. we eat rather healthy. The hospital has become an attractive workplace. The sick leave has reduced, so it's really a win-win situation. So I can only recommend to focus on your staff, not only for the staff themselves, but also because they will become better to support their patients. So that is also a double win situation. Was that a long answer for your question?
Alguna pregunta més o comentari? Sí.
Jo no volia fer cap pregunta, només li volia dir que a Espanya els hospitals promotors de la salut, a no ser que hi hagi hagut alguna incorporació recent, són 20 hospitals en aquest moment, dels quals 19 estan a Catalunya i un està a Algeciras. I d'aquests 19 de Catalunya, dos estan a la província de Girona. Només res més.
Yes, I had the translation error. It works very, very well, and thank you for the good job you are doing out there. Congratulations. It's really important that you invite your neighbors from Spain on board. I know that Catalonia wants to be independent. Everybody wants to be that. But think about if you could run the network for Spain, sitting in Catalonia. Wouldn't that be great?
Molt bé, doncs donaríem la conferència per tancada. Agraïm moltíssim la participació i la vostra assistència.